and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. It has been broadcast on Preston, Swindon and St Albans Community Radio. Bristol Community FM's chair and manager have, however, suspended Dialect indefinitely due to a nearly 30-minute long excerpt of a speech by Bible scholar Gail Ripplinger. This week, how to build your own home, Ecomotive and Jackson Moulding from a local organisation that does self-build. Also, radical Islam and radicalisation, John White talks from the Malverns. And also Ian, who's been living in his car. Has he been housed yet? Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol just off Queen Square on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But first this week, before all that, we're taking a look at RFID. What does it stand for? Well, Radio Frequency Identification. These are little chips, for example, in your contactless payment card and in your mobile phone. In fact, they're all over the place, but we don't really know they're there, and there's very little checking up on them at all. This is by Pippa King, and Pippa King is online. She lives up in Hull. She's online at pippaking.blogspot.com. RFID tagging is an identification system, says Pippa, that uses small radio frequency identification devices for tracking purposes. An RFID tagging system includes the tag itself, which is a read-write device, and a host system application for data collection, processing, and transmission. An RFID tag, sometimes called a transponder, consists of a chip, some memory, and an antenna. Some RFID systems will only work over a few inches or centimetres, while others can work over 100 metres, that's 300 feet or more. RFID tags that contain their own power source are known as active tags. Those without a power source are known as passive tags. A passive tag is briefly activated by the radio frequency scan of the reader, say, for example, when a tag passes through a door. Electrical current is small, generally just enough for transmission of an ID number. Active tags have more memory and can be read at greater ranges. For passive tags, the reader activates the passive tag to operate. The electronics in a passive tag is usually simple. It doesn't need to draw a lot of energy from the reader's RF field to operate. Active tags usually get their power from an internal battery, so they've got enough energy available to enable them to transmit at the maximum allowable power. These allow active RFID tags to operate at a much greater range than passive tags and can allow transmissions of data. In active tags, the higher the transmit power, the greater is the RFID range. Transmit power is limited. Each country puts a limit on the transmission power a reader or active tag is legally allowed to transmit, and this is supposedly enforced by law, although there's very little checking. In general, the higher the frequency, the greater is the range. Low frequency is LF, which is 125 to 135 kilohertz. High frequency, that's HF, is 13.56 megahertz, near field communications found in bank and travel cards. Ultra high frequency UHF, 433 megahertz and 860 to 956 megahertz. Also up to microwave frequency, that's 2.45 to 5.8 gigahertz. That's used in Wi-Fi. Also, the final one is the ultra wideband transmission from an antenna, which the emitted signal bandwidth exceeds the lesser of 500 megahertz or 20% of the center frequency. Now that's used for military and industrial tracking. For example, NATO, much of their equipment is RFID tagged quietly, secretly, and NATO can see it as it's moving around the world. This is about passive RFID. In society, RFID is present in retail, banking, travel cards, education, and business. In retail stock, it's tracked in warehouses and stores by low-frequency RFID and is deactivated on the point of sale. In schools and businesses, RFID in cards can enable access to areas, use of machinery like a photocopier. Travel cards such as the Oyster card used in London, you also use RFID to communicate with readers on buses and on the tube. Bank cards have an RFID chip in them to communicate banks' transactions. Hotels and hospitals use RFID to track clothing and other items such as towels and mobile equipment. Holiday parks use it in passes for rides and purchases. Library books tagged with RFID also for stock control. All this data, whilst being handy to operators, also collectively can start to paint a picture of how we as a society operate, how we as individuals operate. We daily use RFID, probably most of the time being oblivious of how we use it. But where and what data it logs about us, we are not understanding. In effect, this technology can track us. Our every move, transaction use of equipment is logged. With the advent of contactless cash cards, this indicates that physical interaction with the technology is not always necessary. We presume when we buy a product that the RFID tag is disabled. Perhaps it is. But how are we to know when this technology is physically small, thin, and possibly embedded in an item, and this has happened? Contactless cash cards are activated at a range of a few centimetres, yet the RFID journal itself warns that a person should stand a metre away from RFID readers so as not to overly expose themselves to the radio frequency radiation emitted from them, as radio frequency is ubiquitous and the RFID tags quite often hidden. What is the extent of the capabilities and applications this technology can have? Well, that's a question that Pippa leaves hanging in the air, and that's about active RFID. Probably the most amazing part of this technology is just how little we know about it. For example, here in Bristol, our main shopping centre, Cabot Circus, has admitted to the local newspaper that it tracks mobile phones right the way round the centre as anyone goes in or out. And of course, that is partly the same sort of thing as the RFID tracking information. So we could have a product on us, for example, that we bought in a shop that's still got an active RFID chip and we wouldn't even know. Well, maybe that's the point. Thanks very much to Pippa King with that review there of RFID. And her website again is Pippa King, P-I-P-P-A-K-I-N-G, pippaking.blogspot.com.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And I'm joined now by Jackson Moulding from Ecomotive here in Bristol. Jackson, first of all, what is Ecomotive?
Ecomotive, hi Tony, thanks. So Ecomotive is a not-for-profit workers' cooperative, and we are an organisation aimed at supporting more people-led housing projects. Obviously, we feel that's an important thing that needs to happen.
Great aim. So have you sort of got your head around the homelessness problem and housing problem? We've got a housing crisis. We've got massively expensive housing, much, much more to rent or to buy than it actually costs to build a house if you take away the cost of the land. And it seems more and more people are using housing and they're using buildings to sort of store their money, almost like a bank, not even necessarily even using it. So I'm guessing that's where you're coming from, is some way around that.
Yeah, well, I think there's obviously multiple angles coming into it. My personal angle is I was lucky enough to be part of a project in Bristol where I was managed to build my own home. Obviously, the house is still owned by the mortgage company, but it allowed me to create a home that I really love being in and being part of a community. And because of that, it seems as though it's why would we not make housing delivery along those lines? Because it's going to be more supportive for people to be able to create places they want to live.
I mean, if you go to other parts of the world, a lot of people do build their own homes. I mean, you don't have to go third world. Places like New Zealand, you know, actually it's quite a normal thing for a family to say, buy a little bit of land quite cheaply and sit down with an architect, build a house and actually get it put together for something like a half of the cost, maybe even a third of the cost, to what it costs to buy a house here that someone else has designed isn't even necessarily what you want.
Yeah, well, the UK seems to be very backwards in this area. I think after the war, the push towards enabling contractors or developers to come in and create the housing to address housing need at the time sort of took away the support around or the drive for people to create their own spaces. And over the last sort of, I guess, 50 years, it's 60 years, it's become less and less. Now, we do still have a self-built market out there. It's growing. But it's not just the self-built sector. It's actually about people's involvement. So it could be community land trusts, it could be co-housing, it could be cooperative housing or mutual housing. So,
but when you say self-build, do you mean actually building it with your own hands, or do you mean buying a bit of land and getting someone else to build it, to buy a home, rather, you know, to buy a home that you've helped design?
Well, I use the term self-build very broadly. So I think there's the term that probably most people would relate to is that, you know, you'd be out there with the hammer and the nails in the pouring rain, like, or, you know, the scenarios we see on Grand Designs. Whereas in my mind, self-build is where someone is involved in the process in some way. So either through working with an architect or working with a contractor or even working with others in a community, it could be a self-build scheme on a site where a group of people go, well, we want to have 10 homes, and they work with a contractor and work out a design that would work for it. So there's across Europe, as you said, you know, Europe seems to be pushing more ahead with this. And we've got, you know, Almere, there's 3,000 self-builds on one site. And
where's that?
That's in Holland. So that's about half an hour east of Amsterdam. So if anyone's happens to be up near Amsterdam, it's worth a trip. And also Amsterdam per se is fantastic in terms of its self-build support. And lots of people that do self-build don't actually pick up the hammer and pick up the saw and things like that. Though the more you do yourself, the more sweat equity
there's this thing called self-finish, isn't there? Which sounds a little bit more, you know, for someone like me, maybe doesn't really want to build their own home, but, you know, a little bit more accessible.
Yeah, so there's self-finish as a term. There's custom build as a term. And so self-finish is where maybe the shell is put up, it's watertight, maybe you can walk into it and it's all secure, and then you can think about the layout in the space, think about what sort of kitchen or bathroom and those sort of things. We've actually got Marie Rapp from Amsterdam Municipality coming on Friday to the event we're running this week in Bristol. And she's going to be telling us about some of their models around self-build, self-finish and custom build.
That's because you're running this week-long course called How to Build Your Own Home.
Yes.
Tell us about some of the what's happening different days during that course.
Oh, well, it's been fantastic so far. We've had, we've just finished our third day. We've had, on the first day, we had sort of more sort of inspirational type things where people were coming in. We're focusing on four speakers a day. And then moving into workshop sort of settings where people can start working through some of the ideas they get. So on Monday, we had almost like the creme de la creme of the self-build world. So we've had John Broom from John Broom Architects, who was part of the Lewisham housing projects, the old Walter Seagull-style housing delivery. We had Jeff Stowe, who's part of the Association of Environmentally Conscious Buildings, and he's also been part of the Lewisham project as well as Walter Seagull.
So what's been happening in Lewisham? This is South London, not the sort of place you'd expect to be amazing innovation going on.
Well, it had quite a while back a real push around Walter Seagull style housing. So Walter Seagull was an architect who pushed for a very simple method of building. So actually coming back to a style of building using timber, which is easy for anyone to get involved in. So, you know, as you said, Tony, you might be thinking about doing a self-finish of anything, whereas actually the idea of Walter Seagull method is it's simple enough that anyone can get involved and actually creates beautiful homes which have that sort of timber feel where... And so that they did a number of projects back in Lewisham quite a while back, and it's growing again now.
Is it like sort of prefabs in the middle of a urban setting? It's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, in a sense, yeah. But it's prefabs where people build the sections themselves on site, and it's, you know, it's all good sort of hands-on stuff.
It's funny because we have prefabs here in Bristol. We've still got quite a lot, and I'm thinking various parts of the city up Whitehall Road. There are all sorts of prefabs still around from the end of the Second World War. Amazing. I mean, obviously they've been refurbished at various stages, but it seems incredible. We're still relying partly on that kind of housing anyway. So, well, why not build a Walter Seagull, something similar, but a bit more up to date and brand new?
Yeah. Well, there is a density issue, and quite often people bring that.
You can't pack them in. You can't pack people in like you can in tower blocks.
Man. Yeah. Now, the tower blocks that we've had in the UK have obviously been quite contentious, and people haven't wanted to live in them, whereas we just went on a visit to Vauban in Freiburg in Germany, and they've got four or five-storey buildings, which you would think if they were done like we do things in England would be terrible places to live, but actually fantastic. They're covered in greenery, they've got balconies looking out, the transport infrastructure around them is really good. There's a tram running right into the heart of it. There's fantastic in terms of the transport infrastructure.
Well, I mean, my wife and I were over in Russia last summer, and I was quite amazed to see these tower blocks in the woods. It was a sort of a big spaced out tower blocks with actually really nice setting, not right in the woods, but big spaces between the tower blocks and right near mainline railway stations, things like that. We don't really see that sort of stuff. It didn't seem to be those sort of imaginative ways of doing things.
Where
so
was
much
that
over
in
here.
Russia? That sounds amazing.
Oh, east of Moscow, probably about 40-50 miles. Okay. And it was a sort of, I suppose, a Soviet style settlement. But uh-huh. What they decided to do was not to have tower blocks on top of each other with concrete in between, but to put fair distances between them and not to chop all the forest down around it. So it's actually quite a pleasant area to be. And when you're looking out of your flat, you don't necessarily see loads more flats or a railway line. You've got forest to look at. And
So
tops of the trees, maybe.
So building high doesn't necessarily need to be negative. And I think in an urban setting, I think there's obviously a push because the demand for land is high. That was one of our conversations we were having today as part of the event, was around land and finding land. Because land prices are high, particularly in urban centres, it's very hard to compete, especially for community groups or collectives that want to take on
a site.
Well,
look, this is the next question. It's got to be, you can maybe be able to build it yourself, but it's still going to cost a fortune, much more than most people. Many people in the country in debt can't afford anything.
Yeah, well, that's part of the reason we've got a huge housing crisis, isn't it? You know, it's like, how do we create shelter for people when, you know, Bristol alone's got, what they say, there's 14,000 people on the affordable housing waiting list. You know, people are trying to survive and get through the day. So how do we embrace the need for shelter? You know, if we also, you know, at the moment we've got COP21 going on in Paris, which is looking at climate change issues. How are we supposed to empower people to think about even the bigger issues if they're just trying to get through the day-to-day?
I mean, even if you can afford to buy a piece of land, you can afford the materials to build a house, how are you going to get planning permission? Actually, the only way to get planning permission for a lot of people, it seems to be the only way anyway, is if you're one of the big house builders.
Well, there is, in terms of financial mechanisms, there are models which are trying to embrace the affordable housing needs. So we've got making it financially easier for people to get involved. So community land trust models are one of the models, because that effectively puts the land into trust to the community. So effectively there's like either an equity share that people have with the community land trust, so they buy into it a bit, or they might rent off the community land trust. Now, for the community land trust to be successful, then it then also needs to be able to access land and find either land that either it can get a subsidised rate, or if it buys it at market price, it then has to find a way to cross-subsidise. So it might have to build some homes which are a higher rate that then bring the finance in to cover.
So by working hard at it, it's even possible for people with very little money to get somehow, even if it's not a foot on the housing ownership ladder, actually get some roof over their head. Where would you suggest? I know you're part of this Ashley Vale place in St Werburgh's, Jackson, and it's really getting people inspired does require them to see what you can actually do with not a lot of money. So is that open? Can people come and have a look at it from time to time? And I suppose also I'm asking, you know, how do people get in touch with you and get in touch with Ecomotive?
Yeah, so the Ashley Vale project is, you know, anyone can come and walk around. So it's by the St Werburgh's City Farm. Certainly there's a lovely little cafe there, so go and have a Saturday lunch or whatever when you're there. But yeah, people can come and walk around the sites and look around. It's not the only exciting project there we have in the UK. You know, there's the Lilac project that's up in Leeds. That's on a mutual housing basis, and that's people contribute the amount of a percentage of their wages to the rent that they have to pay. So if you earn a lot, you pay more. If you earn little, you pay less. There's the Lancaster co-housing project. There's the Hockton housing project. There's projects in Brighton all around, as well as across Europe. And actually this Friday, in the space at PRSC and Stokes Croft, we've got Ted Stevens, who's going to be coming and talking about the research that they've just done through NACSPA, the National Custom and Self-Build Association, where they've investigated community housing projects across Europe, and he will be reporting back on some of the best of those. If people want to come and get involved in what we're doing, then certainly they can look at ecomotive.org, which is our website. And actually, if people want to come and get involved, I think Thursday, Friday, we're completely booked up now. It's been complete sellout in terms of
how do people stay in touch with Ecomotive? Have you got a mailing list or something?
So people can go to our website and there's a place they can leave their details, and we'll send out newsletters when, you know, as and when. Also, we tell people about events and things that are happening. So people can just sign up and leave their email address for when we send stuff out. But we still have, there's still some space on Saturday, this Saturday, which is 5th of December, which we've got, again, some fantastic speakers coming in and talking about what's happening in Bristol as well as further afield. So we've got Sam Brown coming, who's also been part of NACSPA, been doing some of the research across Europe, as well as work in London as part of the Water Seagull, the community-led housing project in Lewisham.
Well, it sounds like Britain is slowly catching up with the rest of the world on self-build, and certainly Bristol is anyway. So thanks very much for joining us, Jackson from Ecomotive.
Thanks, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And I'm joined on the line now by John White from Malvern. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, John? I know that you've been involved in what you might loosely call the truth movement for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Tony. Yes, I've been involved in the UK truth movement for a good many years now. I've been a truth seeker for something like 25 years. About 10 years ago, I suggested I get involved in the 9/11 truth movement in the UK, and you and I had a good collaboration through those years. And generally, I see myself as an independent philosopher and looking at the issues and trying to create perspectives, share them to be helpful.
So how do you make any kind of difference or distinction between conspiracy theories, which are crazy conspiracy theories, in fact, sometimes even deliberately put out there to confuse people, with real investigative journalism? How do you draw that line?
I think the first thing is you have to have certain principles and techniques that you follow, Tony. And the one I use is the back burner principle. I take a piece of information and I don't rush to judge it. I don't rush to decide if I think it's good or bad or part of this or the other. I let it sit there. I let more information come. And over time, you can have a theory about something, but if it's veering towards the truth, you will find things which are verifiable that start to back it up. Once you've got a theory that fits verifiable facts, you're getting towards some kind of truth.
And what about this recent, I suppose I say recent, but within the last sort of 5-6 months or so, we've seen an enormous increase in the news coverage of migration, particularly into Europe. And it started pretty much, if my memory serves me correctly, around about end of June, beginning of July, with a Siemens dispute. The DFDS shipping company were taking over My Ferry Link. And that at that point on the Calais run, there was strikes by the French DFDS workers who didn't want to be taken over, but they had been, and there were tyres being burnt. And this is where I think, for me anyway, a lot of this started, is that the operation stack, the lorries backing up down the M20, a horrendous situation, was turned into, rather than an industrial dispute, it was turned into a refugee crisis. In fact, no, a migrant crisis is what they called it. And that's where this sort of burst into the scene in the summer of this year, 2015.
Well, of course, the French strikers, being French, are very good at striking. They know where to burn tyres at a critical point. They caused some serious chaos to the tunnel security operations in the camp at the jungle. The striking French port workers... ferry workers, they cause serious chaos, as French know how to do when they strike. They burn tyres in the right places. The channel security forces were completely overwhelmed, really trying to cope with that. And then, of course, the migrants at the jungle were ready to take advantage. And they did. And those provided very dramatic scenes. And I think, you know, it's the old thing, you can maintain the illusion until people can't be protected from the consequences of what's going on. And I think what happened with the impact on the British economy of all the trucks being held up, the hauliers reporting how unsafe they felt, people noticing how unfair it was that hauliers get fined if they get people get on their wagons, you know, and it has brought that whole situation onto the UK news. But I think I would say that everything actually started 2-3 months before that with what was happening on the beaches in Greece and Italy, and the failure of the European patrols of the Mediterranean suddenly letting the people carriers get lots of people across the Mediterranean Sea.
What about radicalisation? Because it's created this kind of particularly kind of a backlash, nationalistic backlash, usually by white people, white groups across Europe, saying we don't really want these migrants, whether they're refugees or not, coming into Europe.
Well, I mean, of course it has. And any anthropologist could have told you that was going to happen, because we're talking about a clash of cultures here.
Now, at this point, Skype started breaking up, so apologies for the sound quality in the rest of this interview with John White.
Radicalisation, I've looked into it and I've found it, but it's a much bigger picture than I at first assumed. You mentioned Western Europeans becoming radicalised into race supremacy. That's certainly part of it. I think probably what a lot of people right now would think about if you said radicalisation, they'd be thinking about European Muslims becoming radicalised to join ISIS. And that's definitely a very real issue which is going on. So in terms of radicalisation, you've got the Muslims who are Europeans, and you've got any Muslims who are coming into Europe, whether they're refugees or economic migrants or illegal migrants or whatever their international legal status might actually eventually turn out to be resolved as. In terms of European Muslims, there's some things we really need to note. The first is that this is not happening in mosques, or if it is, it's very rarely happening in mosques. But it's happening at meetings outside of mosques, it's happening within families, and it's also happening completely outside of all of that through iPhones and the internet. So that potentially any young Muslim who's disrespected and looking for some answers in life could easily start to come across ISIS propaganda. And that's another part of this, because actually ISIS radicalisation is affecting Western Europeans as well. People all over the world are becoming radicalised to join ISIS. People who are secular Australians who have got no family connection to the Middle East whatsoever, you would never think there was any reason they'd become radicals, but they have.
Hang on, John.
And their fate is unknown.
Hang on, John, because people are getting radicalised, but not necessarily to join ISIS, surely?
No. That's part of, you're right, Tony, that's a simplistic way of putting it, because ISIS is just yet another name on the Hydra. And this is part of the existential problem of the threat of Islamic extremism.
But I mean, you and I know, John, you and I know that Islamic extremism, as we now not call it, started really in the 1980s with the CIA funding Operation Cyclone and the MI6 of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. So this is a bit of a creation of the Western intelligence services. Also, we're in the situation now where it's almost as if every extra bomb from the West that falls in the Middle East is creating more recruits. We saw this in Northern Ireland.
Well, you know, Tony, you're absolutely right. And we recently, there were some drone operators, I believe, who went on a strike and whistleblower in the States because they had become aware of how dehumanised to civilian casualties they'd become operating drones. And they come to understand that they were doing more to recruit terrorism with their drone strikes and their attitude to it being a big computer game with no risk to themselves. So that was quite a dramatic story that came out 3-4 weeks ago in the States. But in a sense, I also disagree with you in that let's not give the intelligence services too much credit here. And you're right, the story picks up in the 1980s. Really, I say it goes back to immediately after the Second World War, and the meeting between Eisenhower and the King of Saudi Arabia, which first established the US would buy Saudi oil and in return would leave the Saudi religion alone. And that was featured very well in Adam Curtis's documentary Bitter Lake, as shown on BBC One this year.
Was it actually shown on the TV? John, yeah. Just a factual thing here. I think it was only shown online, wasn't it? Was it actually shown on BBC One as well?
I believe it was shown on the television, but I could be wrong.
I think it was a BBC production that they made great pride in. Oh, we're not actually showing this on the television, even though we've got all these various channels we could show it on. It's only going to go online, which is bizarre in itself.
I've got to admit, outside my expertise there, Tony, I'm a non-television owner, so I'm assuming it was shown at least once.
Well, we all assume that if a BBC makes a programme, then it's going to show it on television. But I think that they're doing this quite a lot now, is where they've said to Adam Cook, I mean, he's considered to be a bit of a dangerous documentary maker, having particularly made a very famous documentary called The Power of Nightmares, which really...
Nightmares and the Century of the Self. Well, there's nothing more dangerous than truth.
So anyway, I know you're looking quite a lot at Europe and the possibility that you've got this kind of a radical milieu in Europe.
Can we just continue on the track we were then? Because we were talking about Saudi Arabia and the US back
sure,
in the
yeah.
50s.
Yeah.
And I think this is ever so important that we understand the theological basis of ISIS or however this state of mind manifests. Because it's spread out of Wahhabism and Salafism. And these are both extremist forms of Islam. Salafism was as practiced by bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. He wanted to see a modern Islam informed and run on traditional values. But his star has now fallen, and ISIS are the hardcore Wahhabists. And these guys, they hate every other culture on the planet.
I guess the idea is really to get everybody to become Wahhabists. Well, that's never going to happen.
No, it's a crazy state of mind, and I think if you're looking at a little desert empire, then maybe you could make a little fiefdom like that, you know, and it'd be a little North Korea or something, and that would be one thing. But this has now become a global radicalising movement.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be surviving.
Slipped outside of any one theatre, even if we exterminated everybody associated with ISIS or anything like it in Syria, we've in no way won.
Yeah, but if you look at the way ISIS is thriving, a lot of the capital keeps it going, that feeds it, that allows it to grow and expand and do propaganda, like an amazing glossy magazine they produce. This is coming from Turkey. The money's coming from Turkey in exchange for oil. So this is a NATO country that's actually key in keeping ISIS alive and afloat and actually helping it to grow.
Well, Turkey has always been torn between the East and the West. Ever since the early days, of course, it was once the seat of Western Europe when it was the Byzantine Empire after the fall of the original Roman Empire. Then it became Islamic, and it stayed that way for many hundreds of years. And it has one foot in Europe, and it has one foot in the Middle East. And what's happening in the Middle East is infecting Turkey in terms of radicalization. And we really don't know how many Turks are actually supporting the imposition of a worldwide theocracy.
And what about the role of intelligence agencies in actually fomenting terrorism and then pointing the finger at Islamic terrorism, as they used to do pointing the finger at the Russians with Operation Gladio, saying, well, actually, we're under attack. Well, actually, it's the intelligence agencies themselves that are doing the attacking.
Well, that's always been part of how the cloak and dagger games work. And with any particular incident which is claimed to be an attack, unless we can do a thorough investigation of all of the facts of that and establish everything, we could never be 100% certain that it isn't somebody flying under another flag. However, there seems to be more than enough verifiable information that there are genuine jihadists out there who really don't care about the games intelligence agencies play, because they're playing their own game.
What about things like the PREVENT strategy? Now, this is put forward by the British government here in the UK as the solution to this. The idea is to stop people being radicalised into any kind of action. But, I mean, there may be perfectly legitimate actions, you know, political actions, for example, to take from someone who's radical. Well, what do you make of things like PREVENT? And where do you think this is heading in the future?
UK government attempt to combat radicalisation inside the UK. I believe its budget is in the region of 40 million, and it had its problems. I mean, it's been mistrusted by the Muslim communities in towns like Luton and Bradford on the basis that there's been pressure through the government, or it has been alleged that there's been pressure through the government to inform on members of the community through PREVENT, which PREVENT have had to be quite forceful to say that they're not going to do is try and keep some sort of cohesion with the community. There's also been a big shift in emphasis in the last couple of years, away from don't become an ISIS fighter to don't take your children, and an attempt to get traction on the issue as a child safeguarding measure, and also to get authorities more ready to act to prevent people leaving the country to go to places like Syria on the basis of safeguarding children from radicalisation. But it's the state interfering in the family, crossing all sorts of boundaries. Rights violations are bound to occur whenever these sort of things happen, and of course the big problem is the bombs keep falling.
Well, what about taking a wider view, say even a 10-year into the future view, John? Where do you see Europe heading, particularly with the growth of some of these right-wing movements against migrants?
That's a very interesting question, Tony. And I think it really depends on what does turn out to be true and what does turn out to be false. In terms of if we're going to see a pattern where ISIS struck Paris with Charlie Hebdo attack in January, they may strike Paris again in November, but of course ISIS is striking all around the world, and there's thousands of terrorist attacks, but not so many inside Europe itself. If that stays the case, perhaps we won't see too big a social change directly as a result of ISIS attacks, although cultural pressures with Muslim immigration is going to be another matter there. But if ISIS attacks become more and more frequent, then the really nightmare scenario is that 10 years down the line, Europe looks a lot more like Israel. By which I mean that, you know, if we get into areas becoming ghettoised, there's certainly big concerns about towns in Sweden, Malmo, areas of eastern Germany, areas of Belgium. If any of these become real no-go areas, the first response is fences and batons. They never last, they never work, and it becomes concrete walls and machine gun posts.
But so, I mean, John,
that's the sort of risk we're looking at,
John,
in the transformation of European society.
But how on earth would ISIS make any recruits from just murdering innocent people in the street? Surely that's going to, any normal person is going to be totally repelled by this. Is counterproductive, surely.
Well, this is where we really need to understand our enemy, Tony, because ISIS are masters. I'm sorry, I don't like to give them credit, but they are. They're masters at the use of manipulative psychological propaganda. And one of the ways in which ISIS is being so successful at recruiting is they are recruiting by telling a lot of truth. And the problem with the West is that the West has got plenty of nasty truths to hit it with. Because, you know, we're struggling all the time to fight against globalisation and the fascism of plutocracy and the effect on democracy of corporations buying up politicians and subverting the democratic process. But we could say that's the summation of the European Union itself, that we've been part of a slowly emerging corporate fascist state. So we've got big problems in that sense.
But John, look, you've avoided my question a bit there. I mean, I can understand people being attracted if the ISIS were hitting the institutions, which you've just been talking about, but they're killing innocent people in the street. This is simply going to repel. It's becoming more like...
Let me make that point a bit better. My point is that when ISIS are propagandizing, for example, it says that a very high majority of ISIS jihadists believe that 9/11 was an inside job carried out by Israel. And I think we really got to think about the consequences of that statement, that they're using a lot of really verifiable truth and then using that to suck people into the narrative of the nobility of their cause and the rightness of their aim. And by that point, people aren't seeing the bodies on the street, they're seeing the injustice of the treatment of the Muslims by the West.
It seems to me what you're saying is that because of the failure of the Western media, particularly to investigate, and Western parliaments to investigate 9/11, they've left a kind of vacuum which ISIS have jumped into.
Of course they have, absolutely, because, you know, when you suppress the truth, it's there to be exploited by your enemies.
Now, John, before we finish, can you just give us an idea of how people can follow you, find you online, and whereabouts you hang out?
At the moment, I'm mostly found on Facebook, actually, Tony. I haven't got much of a presence right now, but my Facebook page is tomolvermessages@btinternet.com. Will find me on Facebook. If I could finish up with one point, Tony,
sure.
Here, we've talked about a lot of good stuff there. I want to talk about, just briefly, about the cultural aspect of this, because what we have here is we have a very strong, masculine, aggressive culture that fervently believes that society should be run on God's law, not man's law. And that's what Europe as a whole has got to struggle to come to understand, because we've had a lot of wishful thinking and a lack of understanding about the difference in the worldview of the Islamic cultures. We've had political doctrines like Islamophobia have been used to try and ease and also to deflect criticism. And what we haven't really got into is understanding that theocracy is fundamentally incompatible with Europe. And that the Europe we have today, the secular democratic Europe, is man's law. And it's that way for a reason, because Europe bled and suffered to throw off theocracy. And when it comes to it, this big issue is, can Muslims integrate into democratic secular society or not? And that means accepting, along with every other faith and religious group, in unity of all Europeans, that it's man's law rules here. Without that, and the more that the Muslim population grows, the greater the chance is that we're going to have something explosive culturally happen within certain areas.
Well, the irony of what you're saying, of course, is that you've got a secular state in Syria run by President Assad and backed by the Russians, which the West seems to be trying to smash, John.
Well, we have a secular state blocking that helpful pipeline from Saudi Arabia so the Saudis can compete with the Russians to the European energy market. So, of course, there's oil, it's petrodollar, and the whole geopolitics of that is fundamental to why they're fighting in that region in the first place. I mean, it's impossible to understand what's going on without understanding that.
Okay, John White, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
You're very welcome, Tony. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And I'm joined now in the studio by Ian, who we've been talking to really over the last 3 or 4 months, Ian, isn't it, on and off?
Yes, hello, Tony. Nice to see you again.
Let's just refresh the listener's mind on this one, because your situation is you're living in your car, and we had you on originally to talk about why you were living in your car, why you couldn't get anywhere to live. What's the situation now? Have you got any help?
Well, the latest is I'm still living in my car in Patchway. I've been there for 7 months. I've been attacked by the police once. I've been attacked by a Polish lorry driver only last week.
Attacked?
Yeah.
Okay, tell us about those various attacks. Is this a physical attack? You know, what's going on?
The police came around, and because I wouldn't wake up, they decided to kick my feet to wake me up. They called it tapping. So now my impression of that is when we kick someone, that's kicking. When they kick us, that's tapping, okay?
Just explain, though, the situation. I mean, you know, surely you can get you've got some money. You've got quite a bit of money,
yep.
But you haven't been able to get anywhere to live. This sounds crazy.
Private landlords do not want to rent to the unemployed even I've got friends who say that I'm working for them or I'm on a leave of absence, and private landlords and letting agents don't want to know. As soon as you mention the word unemployed, but I've got money, they don't want to know.
Why don't you get a job?
I can't get a job. I ain't got a flat.
You haven't got an address.
No.
I mean, really, it's not.
I have got an address. I can use my friend's address in Bristol, who's been very supportive over the last 7 months. I'd like to thank all my friends for supporting me over the last 7 months. Without them, I don't think I'd be here today talking to you again. You know, so I'd like to say a big happy Christmas and a new year to all my friends in Bristol, Birmingham, Pembroke.
Anyway, look, you're in a situation where you haven't got the basic amenities most people have, like a toilet.
No,
you haven't got
no.
anywhere to wash immediately in the mornings. How do you cope?
I go in McDonald's. I have my breakfast in McDonald's. I have a wash down where I go into the disabled toilet.
Yeah.
Wash what I can, dry myself off with a towel. When I go and spend the day, you know, going to the libraries, going, you know, just catching up.
Do you use a laundrette?
Yeah, I bet a laundrette in Hawfield.
But this is becoming a habit, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Do you actually like living in your car?
I'm not being funny, yeah. I'm not paying rent, so the greedy landlords and letting agents aren't getting their wonga off me. You know, they're having to let... There are properties up for let that are still empty. You know,
so it's a financial decision for you, really. It's looking at how much you'd have to be paying for rent and how much you're having to pay in your car. You're almost like a gypsy, aren't you?
Yeah, and as we spoke on my last visit about my hobby of aviation photography, means if I get a message on Facebook, Twitter, I can simply go to the Morrisons as the Shell garage, fill my car up with diesel, drive for 3 hours up to to RAF Milknall, Lake and Heath in Suffolk, and I can spend a few days looking at aeroplanes that are very rare to the UK.
Well, I don't know quite how you cope, but how's your health? Because I know last time you were talking about having some sort of, like, I think it was a diabetic problem or something like that. Because obviously, if you've got health problems,
I've got health
you
problems.
Don't want to be living in your car. Tell us, if you don't mind, about how you're coping with those.
One of the problems I've got is I've got a long-term injury called policeman's heel, which a lot of athletes get, and can only be fixed by a steroid injection or long-term exercise. I recently had a scare where a part of my leg, all the skin came off. And, you know, on a previous visit, I said that I might have to have my leg cut off. It was that injury that came up. And basically, if it wasn't for the medical staff at Bradley Stoke Library, I'd be minus a leg. So it is causing health issues. I've now got a stinking cold. Which you can't shift living in a car because you've got no warmth, you can't rest. The main problem that I've got with my legs is they need 12 hours rest a day. You cannot rest sleeping on the back seat of your car, the passenger seat of your car, because the leg is not stable.
So, I mean, are you entitled to the basic sort of disability benefits? I mean,
no,
that sounds... Why not? I mean, hang on. I'm actually getting quite angry now.
Well,
if you have to have that sort of attention, you should be getting these basic disability benefits, shouldn't you?
I had a meeting last week with the housing people from South Gloucestershire.
Oh,
Council.
Brilliant. Okay, now the reason you had to go to South Gloucestershire was because that was where your last place of residence
was, yeah.
Okay, so how did it go?
Well, they've admitted there has been mistakes made by the housing associations who have stopped me from... Because on the bidding process, if you come like number one, two and three, you get a phone call from the housing association saying, look, do you want to view this property? Well, they've been rejecting me because... They're not talking to, you know, every department is not talking, you know, like you've got the housing associations, they're not talking to the council. You've got the council who have got caseworkers.
So you're saying basically the bidding process isn't working for you?
No.
So you're sitting there bidding for places. You're getting a potential offer, but then they're not contacting you. What's happening?
Well, basically, a former caseworker of mine, who I would like to name, but I don't think I'm allowed to, Nigel Martingale, was my former caseworker, who got a phone call from the council and said he's moved to Suffolk.
From the council said that
he
to you?
He told the council that I'd moved to Suffolk.
Right, so the councillor's saying, oh, well, we're not going to accept this person's bid because you've gone to Suffolk. Yeah. So it's almost like they're looking for any excuse to say this person doesn't deserve housing. Even though you've just gone on a trip to Suffolk, you're coming back the next day or whatever.
Yeah. Good the trouble God. Was, Nigel Martingale was, you know, come up to me and said, I've been told by my company, Knightstone, that I'm not allowed to be your caseworker anymore because I've got too many clients and...
So has he worked for Knightstone or for the council?
He worked for Knightstone.
So why is he telling the council where that you're in over in East Anglia?
You'd have to ask him that.
Dear, oh dear.
I know, so, I did talk, I have spoken a lot in the past about moving up to Suffolk, but I was up there, like I said earlier, the other Friday, and there's no jobs up there.
Well, this is a great pity that they've still not... Did you get anywhere when you sat down and talked to South Gloucestershire? Have you got?
Yeah, I've actually moved forward because of arrangements I've got next week. What they've said is come back in the new year, we'll do a proper assessment on you, we'll go through your needs, like because of my knees and my ankles and my diabetes, then so hopefully something might happen in the new year.
Well, go okay. Look, before we say goodbye, Ian, we've got to talk a little bit about your passion for photographing aircraft. Basically, you're a plane spotter, aren't you? You're a spotter.
Yeah.
One of the top-notch planes at the moment, which the British have now, just over the last few couple of months, have announced they're going to buy 138 of these F-35 it is, isn't it? Not an F-22. An F-35 Lightning, I think they call these
Lightning
things.
Twos.
Tell us a bit about that, because I know, have you actually ever seen one of these?
I've seen five plastic ones. I've never seen a real one.
Never a real one. The Brits are buying these things. I've read several reports. One of them saying that they can't turn, they can't climb, they can't escape, for example, they can't manoeuvre, that they would be beaten every time by the Russians, say, in a dogfight, this kind of thing. They've even been beaten, apparently, by the F-16, which is a 1970s design plane. But yet we're buying nearly 140 of these things. 148, is it?
Yep.
At £150 million each, and yet... There's probably, anyway, what have you found out about whether this jet is worth spending that money?
It's rubbish. It's useless. We'd be better off bringing the Battle of Britain Memorial flight out and fly them.
What makes you say that?
Awful. It's the worst. Basically, what the Americans what they're trying to do is they're trying to build a fleet of F-22s as the main air superiority fighter. And the F-35 is supposed to be the F-16 replacement.
So what's that? A fighter?
Yes, a multi-role.
Okay, so you've got some aircraft that can do ground attack and bombing, and you've got others who are like more like interceptors.
Yeah, yeah. Basically.
So which is which?
The F-22 is the air superiority fighter.
So that's an interceptor. The idea is like the old World War II fighter plane. Yeah.
The F-35, is supposed to do everything the F-22 does and more.
Right, so that would be used for a ground attack, bombing,
ground attack,
that sort of thing.
One of the roles, it's one of the aircraft it's due to replace is the A-10 Thunderbolt II Warthog. It is the world's most ugliest looking plane. But in its role, you can't beat it. When it's on operations in Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, anywhere in the world, the last thing the Taliban, ISIS... whoever we're fighting wants to see is an A-10. The A-10 is the world's most deadliest fighter. It's ugly as hell, but it's built around a gun, a GAU-8 Avenger Gatling gun. This can fire 20 miles away, and it goes straight through anything. It goes through armour piercing. It can destroy a Russian tank.
But they're not. I mean, these F-35s are not going to be replacing these warheads, yeah. Surely, are they? Really?
Yeah. Oh, but president, the trouble is, you've got a president who doesn't know anything about defence. It's a bit like the Labour Party have elected Jeremy Corbyn as their new leader. He's already stated on the record that he will not press the button if it came to pushing and shoving and we had to push, he won't push.
Hang on,
it.
because the British nuclear deterrent, it's the Americans that get to decide whether we use that or not.
That's not.
Yeah,
that's not.
It's not an independent.
Ours are independent.
Deterrent. No,
ours. Ours and Tony, I know more about things like that than you do. And I'm telling you, us and the French are independent of the Americans. Yes, our armed forces work a lot closely with the Americans and the rest of the world, but I'm telling you that the UK in nuclear Trident missiles are independent from
the
Americans.
So if the Americans didn't want us to fire them, they couldn't stop them? Because, I mean, they rely on all sorts of US navigation. It's a US navigation system, for example, isn't it?
Yeah. They can't stop us. The only person in the world that can stop us is Jeremy Corbyn if he ever gets elected Prime Minister.
I mean, what's the point in using a nuclear deterrent anyway? I mean, you know, who's threatening Britain with nuclear bombs? Nobody.
Russia.
I mean, that's an old Cold War point of view, sure.
Yeah, with the Cold War, the Russians are still there. The Russians under Putin are more deadly than ISIS.
So do you think that the Russians are more likely to cause terrorist attacks in Europe than ISIS are?
Well, let's see. They shot down MH17.
Well, some people say that, yeah.
They did.
Well, not necessarily. Okay.
Talk to GCHQ. Well, talk to 51 Squadron, RAF Wellington. Talk to the 55 Reconnaissance Winger off at Air Force Base.
They've got absolutely no reason to do that. They've got no reason to do that.
They've got recordings of Russian commanders on the ground.
Why haven't they released those then?
Because they can't.
Why not?
Official
of course
Secrets
they can.
Act.
Yes, they can. Of course, they leak all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, unfortunately, Mr. Snowden is safely tucked away in the Kremlin, so.
You think he should be arrested? Because, I mean, he's blown the whistle.
He should be shot for treason.
He's been blowing the whistle on our own people who are actually illegally spying here in the West.
That's what GCHQ does. Every text message, every email you send is monitored by GCHQ at Cheltenham.
Well, let's get back to these F-35s. What makes you think that they're really so, I've read a lot of reports. A lot of them supposedly
have you seen the video footage of the designer of the A-10 and the F-16? He's done about several interviews, and I've watched every one of them on YouTube. And he is one of the co-designers of the A-10 and the F-16. And he said that during trials at Edwards Air Force Base in California, the F-16 was designed in the 70s, can dogfight and beat an F-35 every time. The trouble is they're taking the idea of a stealthy aircraft, and the idea is to keep the aircraft stealthy. When you start adding bombs and fuel tanks and missiles from the wings, what happens? It gives a radar signal to the enemy. A Spitfire is more stealthy than an F-35. The F-35, to me, has been basically flawed from the conception.
Haven't there also been problems with the wings cracking, with the engines as well?
F-35C on the 15th of November this year was discovered to have wing cracks in the spars.
Oh, dear. Well, that's
another
not good, is
disaster
it?
For, you know, not being funny. And the trouble is now the British armed forces are stuck with two aircraft carriers. We got nothing to put on. We've got, in the old days, we had aircraft carriers with cats and traps on. Catapults to launch the aircraft and the rest of the wire to land the aircraft. With the two new carriers that we've wasted all this money on, which is a French designed carrier built by British Aerospace, you've got no You've got no airborne early warning on it. So basically, these carriers cannot defend themselves if they're attacked by incoming aircraft.
It's a bit worrying, isn't it? If you think the thing which was in World War One and World War Two so powerful, the battleships, the cruisers, the big ships, actually they could be sunk in a matter of minutes in a new war and in the next war.
The trouble is now, ever since the Labour government of the 70s scrapped the old Ark Royal with Phantoms, Buccaneers, Gannets, Sea Kings and Wessexes, it was the Labour government that scrapped it. And what did they do? They said that the Royal Navy, they will not fight a war outside the European theatre. So they went out and they bought a fleet of Sea Harriers. They bought three anti-submarine cruisers, and they then converted HMS Hermes, which was an old proper aircraft carrier built with cats and traps on. So they just put a ski ramp on it. The trouble is now we are stuck with the F-35 and we can't do anything.
Well, we've sold our Harriers, haven't we? That was a knockdown price to the Americans, I think.
We sold them to the Americans. They're all stored in Arizona.
Do you think we could buy them back, maybe?
No. What's the point? What are we going to put them on?
Interesting. Well,
We haven't got a boat to put them on. And the trouble is, the reason the Harriers were sold to the US Navy were for spare parts. So even though they're parked up in the Arizona desert, they're not going to be complete. They're going to have engines, they're going to have wings, they're going to have other parts missing to keep the American Harrier fleet going.
So what about this engine for the F-35? Apparently it's not so good. I've seen some, at least, I mean, there's a dispute really online about whether the engine's up to the job.
Is anything on that aircraft up to the job? If I had a choice of a flight and a Spitfire and a flight and an F-35, I'm going with the Spitfire.
And if I had to ask you now to advise the Defence Secretary, if you had his ear at the moment, what would you be advising him to do about projecting British air power? Can you actually, just as a plane spotter, get a reasonable idea of how to develop this in the next 10 years or so? So we have actually got...
You can't. You cannot. You cannot. Basically, we are stuck with two aircraft carriers but can only launch F-35s because of the ski ramp. Now, if we'd built a carrier with cats and traps, you see, the whole argument has been with the F-35 program. When the government decided to do away with cats and traps and go for a ski ramp, that meant that the alternative aircraft, the F-18 and the Rafael, if you've got cats and traps, you can buy alternative aircraft. With two carriers with ski ramps, you are stuck with the F-35.
What about the Harriers?
You can't bring the Harriers back. The Navy don't want the Harriers back. The Navy can't afford to keep the maintenance of the Harrier fleet going. That's why.
But they can afford to buy these planes that don't even perform as well as a Harrier.
Well, that's for the Admiralty to take up. They were the ones that turned round to the Ministry of Defence and said, we are not paying for the maintenance on these aircraft. They're RAF aircraft. You see, the trouble is, like the whole development problems with the F-35, you've got the US Air Force who wants an aircraft that can take off from a conventional runway. You've got the US Marine Corps and the RAF who want a V-style aircraft, vertical short takeoff and landing aircraft. Then you've got the US Navy. They want an aircraft that can land on a conventional runway and take off on a cat and trap carrier. So you've got a compromise from the US Air Force to the US Navy version. You've then got the compromise from all three airframes look the same. They're not. They're all different. The Navy version have got twin nose wheels. The ones for the RAF and the Marine Corps, they've got an engine that tilts in to help it land vertically. The F-35, the one for the US Air Force would be, you'd think, the most easiest to fly. But if every aircraft has teething problems, But the F-35 program from day one has been riddled with problems. And yes, that engine is a worry. It is the most unreliable engine ever built because the RAF never wanted them engines. They wanted Rolls-Royce engines built at Filton.
But they're having to have these unreliable US, is it a General Electric engine or what?
I can't remember. I think it's Pratt & Whitney.
Right. So they're having to be saddled with them. I mean, it sounds like an absolute pig, this aeroplane. Why the hell are we buying it?
Because we're stuck because the previous government went and ordered these aircraft carriers without... You see, the trouble is the Labour Party have a history of buying weapons programmes and not realising what they're buying.
And also they tend to spiral out of control with the costs as well, don't they?
Well, yeah, but the development cost of the F-35 is ludicrous. I think they've called it a $3 trillion black hole in the Defence Department.
So I suppose once they spent their $3 trillion, no one dares to say this is a pig and it should never
They'll find out it's a pig when it eventually, when it starts getting to the fleet and they start falling out of the sky like they will do.
Like those US ones that the American presidents aren't allowed to fly in. What are they called again? There's a US plane.
MV-22 Osprey. It's an aeroplane that thinks it's a helicopter, or a helicopter that thinks it's an aeroplane.
And then when it takes off of an aircraft carrier, quite often it just sort of goes into the drink, and then you have to sit there for a while.
I saw President Obama land at Fairford last year. He was on the ground for 19 minutes. He took off in two helicopters, and we were then told by some guy from the Secret Service that he's not allowed to fly in the MV-22 Osprey because it's unsafe.
Oh, dear. But it's okay for the US Navy pilots to fly it, but not for the president to go
well,
in
you
it.
Got the you got the US.
Yes, I mean, look, there's a systematic problem here, isn't there?
Yeah.
I think what you've got is a defence industry that's more interested in making money out of the public than it is in actually providing something which is useful for actually, you know, for the frontline pilots.
The problem, a lot of the Osprey problems have been rectified.
But surely these things should not go into production and they should not be being used and bought until they're actually proven to be safe and work.
Well, can I say one thing to defend that argument? We won the Battle of Britain with Spitfires with an engine problem. The Mark 1A Spitfires had a carburetor. Now, when you do...
Loop the loops.
Dogfighting. The gravity would block the carburetor. So then when you're going along, you've got duff petrol in your engine. It...
Yeah, you don't want that, no.
Right. So now, we won the Battle of Britain with aircraft with an engine problem. Now, as aircraft have got more and more complicated... Like the F-35 programme.
A bit like our cars as well, actually. Well,
yeah, my car's got a fault at the moment. It's been into Ford, it's been into other people, and they can't find out what's wrong with it. But there's a fault in there somewhere. The trouble is, it's all this computer-generated... You know, no aircraft is foolproof. Every aircraft has got its fault.
Are you saying that these things have become too technologically complicated now?
Yeah. The most complicated part of an aircraft is understanding the systems on it.
So in a way, you see, the defence industry is making these things incredibly technological and complicated to justify their spending on research and development.
Yeah.
But then it means every new technology they introduce, it's another thing to go wrong.
Yeah.
What about the Russian approach? Is theirs the same? Do they have the same problem?
Nobody knows what the Russians do.
I think if you
the only thing the only thing I will say is that beware of the Russians.
If you were to pit a top-notch Western jet against a top-notch Russian jet, who do you think would come out on top?
If you're talking about the F-22 Raptor, which the Americans have got, in exercises held in the Nevada desert. Nobody's ever shot down a Raptor. and that includes the RAF with their Typhoons, the Israelis flying F-15s. Nobody has ever shot down a F-22 Raptor. The RAF conducted an exercise with the Indians with their SU-30 jets earlier this year, and the Indians walked all over our Typhoons.
Oh dear.
The Typhoons is not that good.
So we've got a bit of a problem.
We have got a problem.
In the air.
Yes.
Do you think anyone's listening in officialdom to this?
They are listening. They just don't want to hear the truth.
They don't want to change the decisions they've
already made. Well, the trouble is, not being funny, 35 years ago, we had 5 different types of combat aeroplane in service. We had the F-4 Phantom, the Hawker Siddeley Buccaneer, the Jaguar, the Hunter, the Canberra. Now what have we got? Tornadoes, Typhoons. Tornadoes will be replaced by F-35 when it comes in 2018. But so we've gone from 5 types of combat aircraft down to 2, which is...
Well, a lot of people would say that's a good thing because it means that you haven't got all the different types of different planes to maintain.
Yeah, but the trouble is you've got... you've only got 6-7 squadrons of Typhoons. You've got less than 150 Tornadoes in service currently. It's not what we've got in service, it's how much we've got in service. The Tornadoes have, you know, from the original concept, when it was an utter bag of bolts, has proved to be a reliable aircraft in its type. But we just haven't got enough of them. They're running out of airframe hours like God knows what. We are running out of equipment. The F-35 won't solve our problems. What we should have done is we should take a good look at our defences and model ourselves on either the Israeli Air Force or the American US Navy, US Marine Corps. The Americans can put more planes on an aircraft carrier than we've got. The only good news is we have bought some decent new aircraft.
Which are?
20 Predator drones to be based at RAF Waddington and 8-9 P-8 Poseidons based at RAF Lossiemouth to replace the Nimrod that was retired 5 years ago.
Okay, and well, thanks very much for all your, I suppose, unofficial advice about what's going on with the Royal Air Force and particularly this F-35. And hope to speak to you in the new year again here on Dialect.
Okay, Tony, it's always a pleasure to come and talk to you, you know.
And keep us appraised of your ongoing housing situation.
Okay, I will.
All the best. Thanks. That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans in the past. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Jackson Moulding from Ecomotive, also John White talking about radicalisation, and also Ian talking about homelessness, as well as the F-35 pig of a jet. And also thanks to Pippa King for her talk on RFID chips. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.